Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Foolilove, the Executive Director here at the Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's lecture. From time to time, as part of our founder's mission of thickening the debate in Australia, as well as projecting Australian voices abroad, we bring gurus to Australia so that we can sit at their feet and learn from them, really, about the world and how it's changing. And in recent years, for example, we've hosted Shyam Saran, the senior Indian diplomat, Steve Hadley, who was George W. Bush's national security advisor, Kurt Campbell, who was the author of The Pivot, David Dollar. We've hosted Aung San Suu Kyi and others. And next month, we'll be joined by Hu Shu Li, who's arguably China's most influential journalist. And to that list of friends of and visitors to the Institute, we can now add James Fallows. I'm delighted we've been able to bring Jim to Australia, along with Deb, his wife, and to this Institute as a non-resident fellow, particularly this year. The title for Jim's lecture is Election 2016, Has America Reached Peak Crazy? Jim and I came up with this title over the past week, and I'm glad to tell you that even in the few hours between coming up with the title and giving the lecture, America has got crazier. We woke up this morning to news that Donald Trump had linked Ted Cruz's father to the JFK assassination. And then later this morning, Ted Cruz withdrew from the race, punching and elbowing his wife on the way. I don't know if you've seen that video, but you should. Jim showed it to me this morning, so look at it on YouTube. I mean, it was unintentional. Unintentional, but still inelegant. And we're now left with a situation that the presumptive nominee of the party of Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, and Ronald Reagan is the Donald. There is no one better placed to speak about this craziness than our guest today, Jim Fallows. In my view, Jim is the best long-form journalist in the United States. He has written for The Atlantic since the 1970s, and he's the national correspondent for that magazine now. He was also editor of the US News and World Report. He was, for 2 years, the chief White House speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, the youngest person ever to hold that job, and is the author or co-author of, I believe, 10 books. Jim and Deb have lived in Tokyo, Kuala Lumpur, Sydney, Shanghai, and Beijing. He's been a visiting professor and guest lecturer at many of the world's leading universities, including Berkeley, Harvard, MIT, Stanford, and Yale. He is not only that, all those things, but as I've said a couple of times, the nicest guy on the planet, warm, personable, somebody who is on receive as well as transmit. And all these things are very unusual to have in one human being. So, ladies and gentlemen, at a time when America is getting crazier by the day, there is no saner voice to hear from than Jim Fallows.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you all for coming out today. I guess we have to thank the fates and the cosmos for giving us things to talk about today. Boy, this is an extraordinary moment in which to talk about the affairs of my home country. How many other actual Americans are here? I'm just curious. Everybody else is affected to some degree by goings-on in the United States, and this presentation you're about to hear, starting at 10 minutes to 1 in Sydney, this is the first talk on American politics of the Donald Trump official era. So mark this, this can be part of your, and I'm very glad to be doing it in Sydney, a place I love, in Australia, a country that Deb and I have visited many, many times over the years, at the Lowy Institute, which I've respected for so long and been a friend of, and with Michael, under Michael's auspices, we've been good friends for a long time. I respect so much what he's done as a writer, as a nurturer of talent here at Lowy, and just what the institution under whose auspices we're able to talk about this difficult topic. On the one hand, 30 minutes ago or so, I was coming through an elevator with Sam Rogovin, and some guy heard my American accent and turned around and said, "Oh, I love the Donald on Twitter." You know, he just, so the point here is that the internet has made discussion of American politics a worldwide phenomenon, and you are able to read the same things I read every day in D.C. And so in one sense, the analyses, quote unquote, I'm going to offer to you are just things you can add to the mix with other things you'll read online and impressions you've derived yourselves. Also, you should know that I was one of the countless people who did not predict that Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee. And I will explain why that was the case and what it might lead to. On the other hand, I've spent a long, long time looking at politics and how people rise and fall. Deb and I, for the last 3 years, have been traveling around the innards of the United States in our little propeller plane, going to cities that have been affected by economic stress of one kind or another and reporting on how they have rebounded. So we have that at least claim to credibility in what is going on in the United States right now. And with that preface, here's what I'm going to try to do in the next, say, 35 minutes before we have time for conversation. First, these are going to be various ways of talking about how we got to this pass of having, for the first time in American history, a major party's apparent presidential nominee who has absolutely zero public office experience, absolutely zero military experience, absolutely zero demonstrated knowledge of any affair of state or anything else. As a side note, I got a message about a month ago at the Atlantic site from a woman whose livelihood is transcribing TV talk shows. She says that she probably is exposed more to the corpus of Donald Trump's thought than anybody else on earth, because she says she's recorded hundreds of his interviews. And she said, what is remarkable about this is that there is no evidence whatsoever of knowledge of any topic at all that comes through the hundreds of hours of his discussion. With one exception, the exception illustrating the rule, the laws of eminent domain, of what it takes to kick somebody out of the, that he has showed sort of detailed knowledge of that, but the rest not so. So we're going to talk about how we got to this pass. First, I'm going to talk about what this means, sort of the meta story of the Republican Party itself. It's possible, and I would argue likely, we're seeing the historic end of the Republican Party. You know, born in the 1850s, about the time when the Atlantic Monthly was being founded, but how the Republican Party got to the state where it is nominating not Mitt Romney 4 years ago, not John McCain 8 years ago, but the man who has mocked John McCain as a loser for being captured by the North Vietnamese, and then how they got it. Second, I'm going to talk about the state of the United States circa 2016, and whether or not Donald Trump's rise should be seen as a natural exudation of what is going on in the country. I'm going to argue maybe a different case from what you've heard from other mainstream commentators about that. Third, I'm going to say what I think did happen, of why there was a sort of perfect alignment of circumstances that uniquely led to Trump being able to have this role. If any of the things had not happened, it might have been the case. Then I'm going to talk about what this might bode for the general election. We know now that Trump is very likely to be the nominee. Is he likely to be the president? I argue no, but I'll explain why that's the case. Then I'll talk about what this means for the world and what it means about the fate of democracies. So that's the plan in now the next 33 minutes or so. On the fate of the Republican Party, there's a reason that the Trump era seems surprising and beyond our grasp. Because in addition to Trump himself being a literally unprecedented figure to have reached the stage, the only even remote comparison would be Wendell Willkie in 1940, who had not held public office, but he'd been involved in all sorts of public policy decisions over the years before he ran against Franklin Roosevelt. So not only is Trump himself unprecedented, but nobody who is now alive remembers seeing a major American party destroy itself, because the last time it happened was with the Whigs, going through their pangs before the Civil War, which gave rise to the Republican Party of John C. Fremont and then Abraham Lincoln. And I think the way that I bookend this stage in the Republican Party's devolution rather than evolution is with two books. One of them is by a man named Kevin Phillips. It's called The Emerging Republican Majority. I don't know if any of you remember that. It was published in 1969. And it was essentially the intellectual basis for what became known then as the Southern Strategy of Richard Nixon. And the Southern Strategy, in short, was the idea that if the Republican Party could peel off white people in the South and the Sun Belt and make them not the solid Southern Democratic base, but the solid Republican base, then they would have the foundation for a long-term electoral college majority. And in fact, That was a strategy that Nixon pursued for his two terms before his resignation. Ronald Reagan had his variant of that. The various presidents, Bush did too. But there was, I think we're seeing now the road that ended up to, led to, and I'll bookend with the other book, which came out about 2 months ago from my friend E.J. Dionne, whom I have known since we were on the college newspaper together, which was called How the Right Went Wrong. And essentially the way that the Southern strategy put into place under Nixon of appealing to, of trying to combine an economic argument of lower taxes, essentially reducing the welfare state, building that on a electoral base of sort of race resentment, anti-foreignism, cultural conservatism, that this was an unstable alliance in the long run, that sooner or later you would see the kind of fracture we're seeing now, where you have establishment Republicans, quote unquote, in the persons of Jeb Bush and Kasich and Marco Rubio or whatever, being losing to Donald Trump, who is having a more or less raw nativist argument against immigrants, against various minorities of different kinds. And E.J.'s argument, E.J. Dionne's argument, I think is quite powerful in explaining the rage you find on the Republican side now. I distinguish the Republican side from the Democratic because there is frustration of various sorts on the Democratic side. People, as I'll get to, have their complaints about Hillary Clinton. There is no precedent for a husband and wife presidential partnership or sequence in U.S. history. And so there's frustration on the Democratic side, but that is nothing like the rage of American conservatism from talk radio to these rallies. And E.J.'s argument, which is sort of the culmination of the Kevin Phillips argument, is that for now 25 or 30 years, Republican politicians have won office by promising something they knew they could not deliver. And what that thing was moving America further to the right than America was going to move. Ronald Reagan, for example, campaigned on a pro-life, anti-abortion platform and didn't do anything about abortion as president because, again, the sort of center of American politics didn't allow that. Candidate after candidate has railed against big government and against cultural liberalism and all these things. But the feeling on the right is that one after another, these conservative presidents have destroyed them, betrayed them. You all know the term RINO, Republican in name only. This is sort of the curse that comes from a more and more right-wing base about the people who have betrayed them. John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, nobody's idea of a softy or a pinko. I mean, emotionally a big-hearted guy, he's always crying, but nobody's idea of a pinko. He finally was driven from the speakership of a very heavily Republican majority House because he wasn't hardline enough. And Paul Ryan, his successor, had to be sort of talked into the job because he knew what it was like. And so, and probably the most interesting split you see on this is one that came up about 5 or 6 years ago as the Tea Party was beginning to get full momentum, where on the issue of immigration, you saw a fascinating split within the Republican Party and between Republicans as a group and Democrats as a group. And the split was, is immigration basically a plus or basically a minus for the United States? Of the population as a whole, there's a significant majority. You say it's basically a plus, roughly 60-40. Among Democrats, it's probably 80-20. People feeling immigration is the way the United States has an edge over the rest of the world. It adds variety, strength, blah, blah, blah. Among establishment Republicans, the Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio camp, there is a majority, a slight majority sense that immigration is a positive. Among Trump supporters and the Tea Party, starting about 5 years ago, it's like 80-20, immigration is a threat. You know, that we are losing our country, something's changing, we don't like it or whatever. And Donald Trump, two of whose three wives were foreign born, who's been living in New York, who employs all these illegal immigrants, he's become the vessel of the sense of we don't like these other people coming in. My point is, this is a split right down the middle of the Republican Party. So we're seeing almost 50 years ago, the Republicans decided their future lay with trying to become a more white party, the white person's party. And that's been a big divider over that time. We're seeing the tension therein. One other background point before moving to the next state is that Do all of you recognize the name Reitz Priebus? Reitz Priebus, whose name no one can spell, is a guy from Wisconsin who's now the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And after Mitt Romney's significant loss in 2012, significant number one because of the scale on the Electoral College front, it was a landslide, and significant because it was surprising to Republican leaders. They all thought he was going to win, even until Election Day. He put out this enormous manifesto saying that if we are to have a future as a party, especially in the White House, we have to embrace Latinos. We have to embrace Asians. We have to make ourselves at least plausible to blacks. We have to find some way to embrace the diversity that America is becoming. And what has happened now is like the worst hallucinization, you know, LSD nightmare for Reince Priebus, of having the guy who is the nominee who said the Mexicans are rapists, and some of them are good people, I guess, and is making, wants to bar all Muslims and makes fun of women and makes fun of handicapped people and all the rest. So number one, we're seeing, I believe, the sort of big ship Titanic known as the Republican Party hitting the iceberg. And if, as I expect, Donald Trump loses 6 months from now, there's six more months of this coming. If he loses 6 months from now, I think there's going to be the aftermath, which are beginning even now, are what does this mean? Can a Republican Party reconstitute itself in some other way with some other leader? Is Trump's loss, if it happens, is a reflection of real Republicanism, et cetera, et cetera? So point one in understanding what's happening, the Republican Party has gone from the Kevin Phillips era to what E.J. Dionne is describing, and it cannot endure that way. And what happens after this election, we'll see. Second theme, does the strength of the angriest candidate, Donald Trump, in the whole field, and of the protest candidate on the other side, Bernie Sanders, who seems like he's going to win narrowly the Indiana primary. I don't know if anybody has looked like the last I saw a half an hour ago, he was slightly ahead. That doesn't take him any closer in the delegate count because the Democrats divide them proportionally. But does the success of these two people indicate a festering fury and discontent and anger in the public as a whole? That became the press narrative, I think, in this way. First, most reporters, including me, were surprised by Trump's appeal, and therefore, in my view, most of them, excluding me, overcorrected and said, well, it must be that Trump's getting support because everybody is angry like him, and this is reflecting the real America. I do not think that is the case. As I'm going to argue in a minute, I think Trump is creating a lot of the fury and ginning up a lot of the hatred as opposed to being an expression for it. And the short version of why I say that is a message I presented in my Atlantic cover story 2 months ago, based on Deb's and my travel over the last 3 years, is that there's a very distinctive pattern across the country where everybody feels that politically the United States is in bad trouble. And in terms of national politics, it is. Our national politics are really dysfunctional and dangerous right now. And they hear that the economy is doing badly, and they know that there are all the polarizations of the second gilded age. And they hear that schools are failing, and they hear that everybody's unhappy. And therefore, the very widespread sense in the United States right now that where people live is actually getting better, people sort of dismiss that as anomalies. Yes, we're absorbing immigrants here successfully in Sioux Falls, but we know that Americans are unhappy about immigration. Yes, our schools here in Fresno, California are getting better, but we know schools are terrible. Yes, here in Mississippi, we have much better jobs than ever before, but we know that jobs are going away, et cetera. And I think that there is a contention I made is there is coexisting with the narrative of national decline is a lived reality most places of real problems, but progress against them as opposed to erosion of them. I'll use this historical analogy for any of you who have been in the U.S., in New York or L.A. over the past decades. In the 1970s, crime was going up really badly in big American cities, probably New York worst of all, but in different ways, Miami and L.A. or whatever. In the 1980s and since then, crime in most big cities has gone down. But through the 80s and early 90s, fear of crime went up. People thought, well, I'm not getting mugged, but I know people are getting mugged elsewhere. Crime must be getting worse. And I think it has to do with the ecology of news coverage and all the rest. But something similar is happening now where Survey after survey shows that people, in fact, are not furious. And they know that in the abstract, there are problems for the U.S., but generally, it's a getting better as opposed to getting worse stage in national history, or in the national psyche. There was a very interesting poll in the Washington Post 3 or 4 days ago saying that people of every economic stratum, even the bottom 10%, in every group, people felt as if they personally were in better shape than 5 years earlier. Now, even though we know about stagnation, we know about polarization, but they thought things were bad for the country as a whole, even though in every group, majorities felt that they personally were doing better. And the way to connect this back to Trump is that until the escalator moment, as Donald Trump always refers to it, when he descended the golden escalator with Melania behind him to begin his candidacy last summer in North America, with the immortal words about Mexico saying, they're sending us killers, they're sending us cheats, they're sending us rapists. Some of them, I understand, are good people. Until then, there was no evidence that immigration was a bubbling up source of tension and resentment in the United States. A Pew study about a week before that said, when people were asked to name freely what they were most concerned of, immigration was like number 12. You know, not in the top 15, but not the top 10. And even now, the places with the most intense anti-immigrant rallies and cheers for building the wall are in venues like New Hampshire. Those of you not familiar with U.S. geography, New Hampshire is not close to Mexico, but it's where this sort of fury is being built up. And just to bring this point to a close, our politics are uniquely angry right now. The last time it was like this was George Wallace in 1968, running against Johnson and Humphrey and Nixon. I think it would be a misreading to see this as a porthole into the actual temper of the country. Two other ways to illustrate that. Both Sanders and Ted Cruz, in their different ways, are dissident candidates, but at their rallies, you don't see people getting beat up. You don't see them calling on people to be beat up. And there's not even Cruz, not a big fan of whom I'm not a big fan. Even he has tried to calm down people, said, look, we all have to reason together, etc. So that's the second theme here. The first theme is Republican Party hitting the iceberg. Second, the U.S. not apparently hitting the iceberg, although you would think it from the tone. Third theme, why then is Donald Trump the nominee, or 99% likely the nominee? And I think there is a parallel to the 2000 election, where, as you recall, George W. Bush became the president only after a sequence of like 49,000 things, all of which had to happen one after another to end up with that result. And it's not quite as many in this time that led to Donald Trump's victory, apparent victory in the party, but it's almost that many. First, there are the things not involving Trump himself. The hoped-for vessel of establishment hopes was, of course, Jeb Bush. And a year ago, what people were complaining about in the likely election lineup was another Bush v. Clinton matchup, that what had happened in American politics, that you had this dynastic politics. For a variety of reasons, Jeb Bush was not the appropriate vessel. He spent a huge amount of money. He got very little traction. Donald Trump was able, with his genius for ridicule, to brand him as low energy Jeb, and that just stuck, as did Little Marco. That there were a sequence of debates where Trump would refer to Senator Rubio only as Little Marco and low energy Jeb, and it had an effect. So the backup after low energy Jeb was in fact Little Marco, and he was on paper the candidate the Democrats feared most. Young, in contrast to Hillary Clinton, a much better speaker than Hillary Clinton, of seeming Latino background, but Cuban versus non-Cuban, which has its ramifications. But he too had problems. He wasn't strong enough to bear this weight. The fact beyond that is that even now, even today, we are speaking in the first moment in the last year and a half where it's become a two-person race, where it's only Trump versus Kasich. Governor Kasich of Ohio is apparently still in the race. But until now, it's been this gigantic field where early on, when Trump might have been stopped, when his 30 to 35% share of the electorate might have been insufficient to get him all these delegates. The field was so bitterly divided, and one by one, his opponents wouldn't take him on. Ted Cruz wouldn't take him on because he hoped to sort of collect Trump supporters after Trump faded away. Ben Carson didn't take him on because, who knows, Christie didn't take him on because he wanted to become his ally, et cetera. And so you had a war game in which only the constellation of the number of candidates, the choices they made, the way they spent their effort, only that would have let Trump get through this far. You had the delegate rules of the Republican Party, which in contrast to the Democrats, were set up on a winner-take-all basis. That was done in order to help Jeb Bush. The idea was this would give him an early cushion, but in fact, it perversely helped Donald Trump, where he got, when he was getting 30 to 35% of the vote, he was routinely getting 80 or 90% of the delegates and building a big pad that way. And there's one other factor that I think is very crucial in understanding Trump's appeal, which is that he has the unique range of talents and affect for this moment in campaigning. By this moment in campaigning, I mean that the way that the Republican primaries have unfolded over the last year now almost is indistinguishable from a TV reality show, from Survivor or American Idol or Trump's own The Apprentice or whatever, where there's people are invested in seeing who gets knocked off week by week, and personal bearing and one-liners and swagger and all the rest are what counts. It's also very much like pro wrestling, which I know is not as big a deal here in Australia as it is in the US, but where you have people who are obviously phony, histrionic, tough guy performers. You know, when we get in this ring, I'm going to tear your head off and you don't talk tough to me. And Donald Trump, although he is identified as a businessman, is actually a TV star. He spent 15 years or so as the star of The Apprentice, where his role was exactly the one he is auditioning for now. They got to say, you're hired, you're fired, I'm the decider, you know, I make great decisions. And so it was, there could not have been a better preparation for the role he's auditioning for. And he was also a pro wrestling promoter. There is a video I urge all of you to look for, not for the next half hour, but after that. It's YouTube, and look up Donald Trump shaving Vince McMahon's head. So Vince McMahon was the rival wrestling promoter, a great big burly guy himself, a former wrestler. And Donald Trump and Vince McMahon, the champions from their respective empires, had a match. And the bet was the winner, the owner of the winning wrestler, would get to shave the loser's head. So Donald Trump's guy won. I'm sure it was all fair and square and on the up like the rest of pro wrestling. And so there's this incredible video of Trump getting in the ring with Vince McMahon, having his head in a hammer lock and shaving his head. And it just is, it's both primal and sort of Lord of the Flies-like in its brutality, and just like the Republican debate so far, where Trump has been saying, little Marco, he's so weak, he can't do anything. You know, low energy Jeb, he can't come back at me. And Trump is, since this year, it's turned out the election is a reality show. The reality TV star has dominated. And this is a way of explaining why things that would have stopped any other candidate in American history, he just cruises right through. You know, Donald Trump made fun of John McCain, war hero, as a loser for having been captured by the Viet Cong. I prefer people who are winners who don't get captured. There are like 16 other things that would have stopped anybody before and didn't. And I think starting last fall, we recognized this was a different phenomenon. And the different phenomenon is, again, all these things came together only in this constellation of personality and rules of debate and strategy of opponents could it have led to Trump, and it has. And I can give you more details on that, but let me just move on to the next point, which is, do we then expect that he will be the president? What are the mathematical and strategic and other things? Having said that, I, like other people, was surprised by Trump's success so far, I'll say that the chance of his becoming president is not zero. It's greater than zero. I think Ted Cruz would have been zero. because he's just so an unappealing a figure. Trump is so unprecedented, so protean, so just immune to normal rules of politics. You can't say it's zero. But here's why the odds are very heavily against him. As we get into the more conventional rules of a two-person Republican versus Democratic showdown. All of you know and love the Electoral College, you know, the curse of the United States. And what's interesting is the way the Electoral College can magnify the effects of relatively narrow popular vote margins. For example, Romney ran Obama a relatively close race, close enough that his people, again, thought he was going to win. Who remembers how large the Electoral College divide was? It was a landslide. Obama got more than 330 votes. Romney got 206, something like that. It was an enormous margin. And the reason underlying this, I think, is that Republican strategists know, and many people might not, is that over the last 20 years, the Electoral College has turned into a huge structural advantage for Democrats. You know, the House of Representatives is and the Senate are both sort of rigged in favor of the Republicans. The Electoral College is not rigged, but structured pro-Democratic, because in the last six presidential elections, starting in 1992, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama, there are 19 states that have always voted Democratic. And it's worth recognizing what states these are to think what it would take to change them. They're the states, all the states in the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, Hawaii, the states of the industrial Midwest, Michigan, Illinois, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And then essentially all of the Northeast except New Hampshire. You got New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey, Delaware, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, and Rhode Island, and D.C. And those states that have always gone, they've gone Democratic ever since 1992, together they represent 242 electoral votes. You need 270 to win. So if you take those states plus Florida, that's enough. So if Hillary Clinton only won the states that every Democrat has won and Florida, then she would win. For Donald Trump to win, he would have to win the entirety of Florida and Virginia and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Nevada and Colorado and all these states where there's an increasing Latino population or urban population. And so it is possible to see that Donald Trump could carry this into a Republican victory, but the odds are against him. Only a few things have to go right for the Democrats. A lot has to go right for Donald Trump to have this turn out. Here's another data point underemphasized in a lot of the coverage that's worth bearing in mind. How many people are really excited about Hillary Clinton? There are some, but there are not many. How many people are excited about Donald Trump? Some people are really excited. Nonetheless, in these last 8 months of primaries, Hillary Clinton has gotten twice as many votes as Donald Trump has. And she and Bernie Sanders together have gotten just way more than all the Republicans together have. And so there is a fury and a fervor behind the Republicans, but there aren't as many people as there are when you take Latinos. The latest positive negative I saw for Trump among the Latino electorate, which is our largest minority, it was like 3% positive, 85% negative, which is not a good, you know, sort of over under. It's almost as bad with Black Americans. It's about a 20% underwater with women voters, who are the biggest bloc in the United States, et cetera. So a lot would have to go right. There was a new RAND survey that came out just yesterday showing a default pro-Republican, pro-Democratic sentiments among the likely electorate. And this has been pretty close over recent years. This latest reading is 53% of the voters say they plan to vote Democratic, whoever the nominee is. 36% say they plan to vote Republican, whoever the nominee is. So it could happen, but the math suggests a significant a Democratic win for Hillary Clinton. This leads to my next point of what it is likely to mean for the world if Donald Trump became president. The answer to that is God knows. He would certainly be a less irresponsible president than he has been a candidate, because he could not be a more irresponsible president than he has been a candidate. He just has made up. He said repeatedly things that he knows are not true, and everyone knows are not true. Mexico is not going to build a wall, and it's not going to pay for it. And there's a reason that Japan doesn't have nuclear weapons. I am confident Trump doesn't know what that reason is, but he would be introduced to that reason by his great advisors if he won, et cetera. So I think that the joke you will hear from every American friend of yours in this next 6 months is, depending on how things go in November, you may be seeing us back here in Sydney. But I think that it would be a bad thing for him to become president. Probably not as bad as his being a candidate, but bad. And having somebody with his temperament in command of the world's largest military force is not a good thing. The Atlantic's cover story next month, I will let you all in the secret, is by a eminent psychiatrist about Donald Trump. I'll just leave it at that. I'll say that it will probably not build a lot of support for him as a commander-in-chief. So I'll say likely results, Hillary Clinton, as her effect on the world is, for better and worse, not surprising. The world knows Hillary Clinton. She's been on the scene forever. She was Secretary of State. She was a senator. She'd probably be a little more hawkish than Obama, but essentially she would be the no surprises candidate. Trump would be the all surprise candidate, and we'll see what that means. This leads me to my final theme before I answer one or two questions I'm going to preempt you on, which is what it means for American democracy that things have reached this pass. I have heard over the last couple of days I've been here about the travails of Australian democracy at this stage. I've tried to maintain a straight face while hearing how bad it is here. Oh yeah, I'm really sorry for you with your parliamentary system where whoever gets in by definition has a governing majority, et cetera. So around the world, even in Australia, there are strains on democratic government, and there's some pretty bad ones on US government now. I think the two significant points about this era for American democracy and by extension other democracy, it's not the worst period we've had of national governance. And the reason for that is there was a civil war. So that was worse. But it's tied for second worst with the 1880s, 1890s, where also you had corrupt judiciary, you had all the problems we have now. And people are studying the history of the progressive and populist era, which followed that first Gilded Age, to look for rays of hope, and that's partly what Deb and I have been writing about. And so I think my belief is that the fiber of the U.S. as an entity is strong enough to withstand this kind of failure, but it's a real failure right now. The other thing to say about American democracy is that Trump has already done it a lot of damage. He has legitimize the idea that you will mock people for physical appearance. You'll mock them for their stature or weight. You'll mock them for handicaps. You'll mock them for their religion. You'll mock them for their ethnic background. Things that the strength of the country means resisting. And after having an extremely dignified first non-white president of the United States, to have this racist carnival barker is damaging. And so it's the Republican Party has failed to stop him. We'll see whether the rest of the country can. Now, briefly, in the next few seconds, I have a list of questions I think you might ask. I'm going to give you quick answers. What about the FBI indictment with Hillary Clinton? It's not going to happen. Ask me why, and I'll tell you. What about the missing white voters hypothesis? These people will turn out for Trump. That doesn't matter either. What about the bitterness of the Sanders-Clinton speech? It's not that big a deal in historical terms. Who are their running mates? I don't know. And another question, I'll see if you ask me, and if you don't, I'll answer it myself anyway. So with that, that is my presentation of, this is the first speech of the Trump era. I'm honored to deliver it here in Sydney, and welcome to the new world.
It was a fantastic lecture by Jim. The first time, I think, in the distinguished history of the Lowy Institute that pro wrestling has come up for topic. I am going to go and look at that video of the Donald shaving Vince McMahon's head. I mean, the only thing worse, I suppose if you want to look for the silver lining, the only thing worse than seeing Donald Trump's hair at the moment would be seeing a completely bald Donald Trump.
Yes.
So that's the positive. A very entertaining speech. It reminded me a bit of the way President Obama introduced his speech to the White House Correspondents' Dinner when he said, You know, you all look fantastic in your tuxedos. The end of the Republic never looked so great. So Jim has given a terrific speech. He's then tried to preempt the Q&A period by asking himself the questions and answering them, but we're not going to let him get away with that because this is the Lowy Institute. So people get to ask Jim whatever questions they wish. He has given you some to draw on, but you're also welcome to ask your own. I'm not going to take the chairman's prerogative of asking questions because I've asked Jim a lot of questions in the last couple of days. So let me go straight to you. We've got about 15 minutes for questions, so please put up your hand and I'll take you in the order in which I see. I think I saw Rob first. Rob Thomas, if you could take a mic to Rob. And can I ask everybody, please, because there's going to be a lot of questions today, indicate who you are, an affiliation if you have one, and keep it to a short question, please.
Rob Thomas from LFG. Very quick question. You talked about the Republican Party evolving. What do you see it evolving into, and especially given that the Senate appears to be very right-wing in the Republican movement? So you've got sort of a problem there that you've got a lot of Latinos, etc., who obviously probably are more left-wing, you would imagine. So what is the Republican Party going to actually evolve into to actually either win the presidency and stay in the Senate?
That's a really interesting question. I'm going to buy 15 seconds in answering it by giving you my nominee for the most offensive Trump quote yet that also has not stopped. And this was from an interview about 10 years ago in GQ magazine where they were saying, Melania is so great, your wife. Suppose she were in a car crash and you got all, your face got cut and everything. But would you still love her as much? Trump said, this is on the record, you can look it up, what about the breasts? And the questioner said, well, the breasts are okay. And Trump said, all right then. So this is the guy running for, we're in a country where most of the voters are women. So what the Republican Party will look like after this person loses the election, as I expect he will, is you can define, number one, no one knows. Number two, the likely pieces, there's a libertarian part of the party that for which Rand Paul was the main hope in this campaign of saying, get the government out of your business, but also out of your personal life. And so that is, these people, they sort of like Trump because Trump is being a little softer line on some of these culture war issues and transgender bathrooms and all the rest. They have been hoping for a home in the Republican Party. I guess the most likely candidate, something you could say in shorthand, would be the Bloomberg Party. I think if Bernie Sanders had been the Democratic nominee, which is still possible, but unlikely, you could imagine Michael Bloomberg running as a third party candidate, not winning, but being sort of the responsible, like liberal Republicans of yesteryear. There's no home for liberal Republicans anymore. So I guess the most likely next incarnation to me would be a sort of Bloomberg-esque liberal Republican renaissance.
In a recent column, David Brooks, who cited the work that you and Deb have done, referred to a Joe McCarthy moment, saying history, this is a moment when history will judge how people responded to the Donald's candidacy. Do you think that's true, or do you think they're making a bigger deal of it than it actually is?
I'm grateful to my friend Amy Denmead for the question. So for those of you who didn't see the column by David Brooks, which I would urge you to read because it ended up with praise for Deb and me. So it was one of David's best columns. The early part of it, he was saying that really this is one of those moments people are going to look back on. Where did you stand? And he was comparing it to Joe McCarthy in the early 1950s, where even the great Dwight Eisenhower was slow to condemn Joe McCarthy. And that's one of the things that's held against Eisenhower. But the comparisons would be during the school desegregation era in the 1960s. Were you with George Wallace or were you against George Wallace? The Iraq War is sort of a recent example. And I think to tailor this to an Australian audience, the world should put pressure on American Republicans whom you know to do the right thing. Because Trump is an unprecedented and uniquely malign figure at this stage of American political competition. And Republicans should be shamed out of just saying, okay, well, we'll have to get along. This is the only time in my life I've ever agreed with Bill Kristol of National or the Weekly Standard on anything. But he has a column out just in the last day or two trying to shame the Wall Street Journal for saying, well, we got to line up with Trump because Hillary is worse. I think that there is... You can understand partisan disagreements and all the rest, and we understand the problems Hillary Clinton has, but I do think this should be cast as a Joe McCarthy type of moment. Do you stand for a person who mocks women, Latinos, Muslims, handicapped people, who turns the whole thing into pro wrestling? This should not be an acceptable part of a major democracy's process. So yes, I agree with what David was saying there.
And of course, the Lowy Institute's provided some evidence of what Australians think on this topic, because we released a poll result about a week ago showing that nearly half of Australians would like Australia to distance itself from the United States if someone like Donald Trump were elected, to which Jim emailed me and said only half. So we have some sense of what Australians think about Mr. Trump, and that's quite a striking result given that our poll every year shows that about between 70 and 80% of Australians think the alliance is important to our security. So notwithstanding that, nearly half of Australians would theoretically want us to distance ourselves from Washington if Mr. Trump were elected. Yes, madam.
Deanna Lane from Fastlane Consulting. I watch the news from the US every morning, so I've been watching this unfold, and I thought that the worst quote I'd ever heard was that Donald Trump said he could shoot somebody in the main street and not lose one voter. But my question to you is, Bernie Sanders seems to be really attracting a lot of women voters. I wanted to know why that is, and do you think he would be a running mate, or he and Hillary?
So to answer the last part first, I think it is very unlikely that he would be a running mate, partly because he's older than Hillary Clinton is. While he would bring something to the ticket in terms of his movement, for him it wouldn't be attractive. He'd give up a Senate seat. It's likely the Senate will go Democratic this time, so he could be a committee chairperson. So I think it's likely, there's a list of other people we can go into, Hillary Clinton would likely change. I think that even Bernie Sanders, I'm confident in saying, is surprised by how far he has gotten. He was not running really to become president, but to advance his issues. And he's gotten a lot of support, mainly from young people. And so his support from female voters has been mainly young women voters and young men, too. And he's been very weak among racial minorities. You know, it's been a very white electorate. I think that this is a sign of the weakness of Hillary Clinton. Again, there are some people who are excited about her, mainly her contemporaries, as for breaking the glass ceiling. Among the next generation, it's more, yeah, we need a woman president, but maybe not her. And I think that's a sort of a younger woman feeling. So I think that I believe that the excitement gap for her, that will be less of a problem when it's her against Trump versus her against Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Jim, Mal Duncan from the Insight Group. Jim, one group you haven't mentioned in terms of having any culpability in this is the press in the US. And I'd be interested in your view and how much you feel they've been, I suppose, culpable in allowing Trump to create himself.
Yes, that's a very crucial part of the ecosystem I was meaning to refer to, and you're right that I should have spelled that out further. In his White House correspondence presentation, President Obama zeroed in on exactly this point. First, he was congratulating Reince Priebus on showing up because he was resting after a job well done with the Republican Party. And then he congratulated the press on having given Donald Trump exactly the amount of coverage proportional to his real merits. And the reason, what he was referring to, is that the reality that even serious news shows essentially are part of the pro wrestling ecosystem now. Every single producer knows that if Donald Trump is on the screen, people will watch. If somebody else is, they'll switch to where Donald Trump is talking, because Donald Trump is interesting and he has all these different facets to his personality. And just as all the traits that make someone interesting on a reality show are the ones that he has. And so I think that the postmortems on this election cycle will concentrate a lot on the way that Trump was able deliberately or inadvertently to play on this need of the whole news system to have him on there, because people would watch. I think that will diminish when it's a two-person race, because there's a more formal structure. You have to give equal time for each side, and there's different kind of debates and all that. But yes, especially cable TV news has been a very important part of Trump's free advertising.
Hi, James. Thanks for your talk today. I'm just wondering if the Donald isn't perhaps an aberration against the otherwise sort of global political move away from extreme conservatism to a more progressive era. And I sort of look at that dated from the the end of the George Bush presidency, which I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on the impact it's having on this campaign, but through to the election of Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, the defeat of Stephen Harper in Canada, to today.
So I think that, the Donald would present himself as being actually part of that movement as opposed to an exception to it, because he thinks he's running against the established Republican Party by attacking the Iraq War, by not being a big gay rights zealot, and not talking about Republican tax cuts. You know, he's one reason why it's surprising the Wall Street Journal is lining up with him is that he breaks the orthodoxy of the sort of Grover Norquist, no increase of taxes, ever starve the state kinds of things. And he's not, he says Obamacare is a disaster, but he's, you know, he obviously wouldn't do anything about it. So I think that he is selectively a right-wing anomaly in his nativism and racism, which you obviously see through Europe, many manifestations of that. But I think he would say, yes, there's a reaction against this kind of right-wing ambitious foreign policy and right-wing draconian economic policy, and he, the Donald Trump, is the man to make better deals to correct that.
Thank you, Jim. I wanted to ask you about Klein's most recent book, Unlikable, on Hillary Clinton. Is the unlikable reserved for women candidates only? I mean, Nixon was very unlikable and yet was elected twice. So I was interested in your take on the unlikable descriptions about Hillary.
And is this the Edward Klein book? So he, I don't know, he, I know him somewhat. He has a very unreliable record of writing about the Clintons, of just a real sort of, you know, they murdered Vince Foster and they did all these other things. On the unlikability, there certainly is a gender loading of that. On the other hand, the whole narrative about Ted Cruz has been that nobody likes Ted Cruz. So there are ways in which, and Nixon as well. So I think that the hope for Hillary Clinton, and the reason why I think of everybody on earth she's the most likely next president, is that there are people who might not want to have a beer with her or whatever, but they think they know that she is competent and studious and well experienced, and even those who don't, the ones who don't trust her, know that she is she's a solid person. So there's much less downside surprise risk with her. So I guess yes, there is gender tainting to that, but Ted Cruz is the other example.
I would have thought that most people would just want a competent human being in government, but it seems as if quite a few people have been infected with a need for a messiah, and I think Barack Obama was seen that way, and to a certain extent Sanders and Trump are seen as possible messiahs. Would you comment on that?
Trump a messiah or just a naughty boy?
So to some of his people, he is a messiah. And there's an interesting history in the United States on this. There's a plausible argument that the sort of messiah role of the American presidency began not with Abraham Lincoln, you know, the greatest president, but with Teddy Roosevelt, who was the first sort of public figure, who you couldn't escape hearing about Teddy Roosevelt. And ever since then, while there have been some withdrawn presidents like Calvin Coolidge or Gerald Ford, or to a minor degree, Jimmy Carter, there's been just this inextricable combination of you have a platform and you have ambitions, but also you are some vessel of people's feelings. John Kennedy, for example, is a very important part. There's a reason why Nixon resented Kennedy so, because Nixon would say, look, I actually have plans. This guy is just a pretty boy. And the pretty boy factor just unavoidably has some effect too. So I think this is part of human nature in choosing leaders, but its history in the U.S. seems to date back to Teddy Roosevelt, and it's part of the deal now.
Jim, I'd like to ask you about the SCOTUS nomination. The Republicans have come out and said that they won't confirm a nominee in the lame duck period. Do you think that they're being truthful, or do you think they might change their minds? And if they don't, as a follow-up, do you think that given the divisiveness of this campaign period, Hillary might stick with a more centre nominee, or might she pick a more traditional Democratic candidate?
So the backstory here, for any of you who are not familiar with it, Justice Scalia died a couple months ago now. Before he was officially pronounced dead, the press officer for Mitch McConnell said, we're not considering anybody. You know, that Obama is in his last year, go to hell. You know, we'll have the court remain vacant. There's no precedent for this in U.S. history. This has been on the rational grounds. This is not working out for the Republican Party with the general electorate. It shows that generally people oppose, but the Republican base supports this. So again, it's sort of this paradox of something that's going to hurt them generally is supporting them internally. And McConnell was afraid of his own fire breathers if he compromised. When President Obama nominated Merrick Garland as his successor, there was a lot of Democratic disappointment, partly because Garland is more or less a centrist, and largely because he's old. Old meaning my contemporary, and somebody who's, you want these days in the Supreme Court to get the youngest person you can plausibly get in there so they can maximize the, you know, the shelf life. And Garland in his 60s was too old. So Obama genuinely believes that Garland is sort of the right person for the job. It depends on how the election goes. And I think if the Senate goes Democratic, as it likely will, you can imagine the Republicans trying to confirm him in the lame duck session to avoid having a Democratic Senate consider somebody else. The odds are that the next president will get a couple more nominations. And so that's why both the presidential election and the Senate confirmation matter so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've run out of time. There are lots more questions. I think it was a fantastic conversation, a terrific speech, wonderful answers to questions. Jim was as deft and elegant and persuasive as ever. He's persuaded me as to his argument as to why Donald Trump has done so well, why he won't do any better. But he has not persuaded me that we have reached peak crazy when it comes to the United States.
Yes, that's true.
That may well still be ahead of us. So first of all, please join me in thanking Jim Fallow. Jim will be at the National Gallery of Victoria next Tuesday, if anyone happens to be in Melbourne. He'll be giving a lecture on his recent Atlantic cover story that he mentioned, on why America at a local level is piecing itself back together. So there are still tickets available for that. Let me take this opportunity, as this is Jim's last public event in Sydney, to thank the team at the Institute who have worked so hard to make this such a terrific visit, I hope, for Jim and Deb, Sam Roggeveen in particular, but also Louisa and Sarah Hipsley, Tara Pienaar, Andrea, and other people at the Institute. Thank you very much. Let me mention there are other terrific events coming up at the Institute. On the 19th of May, we'll have Robin Niblett, who's the head of Chatham House, the world-famous think tank in London, talking about Brexit and what will happen in London. We hope to see you there. I thank you very much again for coming and for your questions. And finally, Jim and Deb, thank you again for joining us. We speak often about immigration issues and refugee issues at the Institute, and if you're wrong, and Mr. Trump is actually successful in November, then we'd be happy to entertain your application to come to Australia more permanently. So thank you.